It's so good to see you. And after, I know you've been on a lot of adventures since I last saw you, and I'm trying to follow you as much as I can in your talks, and it's just exciting to see all the places that you're going and people you're meeting, and yeah, really exciting to have you here on this podcast. I think the devotees, well, everybody's going to be wanting to listen to this one. So the first thing I would like to do is just read your bio, your short bio, and then we'll launch into the interview. Okay? So Swami Bhakti Pranay Paminava was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina in 1980. And after a comprehensive existential crisis during his teenage years, he engaged in intense studies and inner exploration, all of which converged in his joining a Gaudiya ashram when he was 19 years old. He remained as a brahmachari for the next 9 years, doing book distribution, puja, cooking, cleaning, and managing, but most especially engaging in his favorite devotional angas, chanting Sri Nam, studying Shastra, and sharing Hari Katha in intimate association with the sadhus. He accepted sannyas at 28, and after a truly unexpected turn of events with his former spiritual preceptor, he accepted Guru Maharaj as his Harinam Diksha and Sannyas Guru on the day of Jiva Goswami's Tirobhav. At present, he is mostly focused in writing, reading, chanting, and speaking, four services that Guru Maharaj emphasized to him as his main duties. For the last 2 years, and probably for many more to come, he spends considerable time traveling around the world in the spirit of relief work. Also, as part of what his Guru Maharaj has requested to him. He has recently published his first book. Let me show this to you. Inherited Bhakti in the Jiva according to the Gaudiya Vedanta, which he is presenting in his present U.S. tour with the hope of rendering some seva to the worldwide Vaishnav community and through that receive the necessary blessings to further engage in that same seva in a more humble and authentic way. So this is on Amazon, everybody. It's in a softback and also hardback version. And it will keep you entertained for many days to come because it's a nice big book. And so I'm excited that I got my book off of Amazon. And then, so we'll try to have that, at least the first chapter by the time you get here. And I would just like to say that I have just been so happy to have met Paminava Swami. He has just added so much value to my life. And I've had the great fortune of getting to spend some extended periods of time with him when he was stranded at our house during COVID, one of those silver linings of COVID that got to have so much of your association. And I can just truly say that aside from being extremely scripturally informed and really understanding how to apply the scriptures in a relevant, contemporary way, he also lives the scriptures in his everyday life. So he's been just an amazing example for me. And he has also prolific speaker and gives so many talks that are just packed full of realizations and just wonderful talks. He has series like Venu Gita, the Brahmara Gita, the Gopi Gita, Panchatattva series, Shikshastakam series, Gaura Astakalya Leela series. I mean, there's so many series that he has done, and I can't listen to them enough. I go back and listen to them over and over again, and those are on Shabda Bhavan, and also they're on iTunes, and I'm sure there are other places as well. So that's my little introduction, and I would like to start. You said something very interesting about having a comprehensive existential crisis, and I'm curious, what exactly was your comprehensive existential crisis, and what did it look like?
Well, good morning to all of you to begin with, Pranam, and thank you, Arjun Siddhi, for your second extended bio of myself that you just shared, and your generous words about me. And I'm equally fortunate and blessed by having your association. And also, to begin with, congratulations for your recent grandchild manifested over there.
Thank you. So
that's a very interesting chapter in your life as well. Yes. So regarding comprehensive existential crisis, well, I mean, if you allow me to track back a little bit before that, just because, I mean, I was not just directly born in an existential crisis, although as Guru Maharaj would like to say, human life is in itself an existential crisis. You don't need to have one. You are one. We are one. And that's about, of course, expected to be solved in a comprehensive way, given the comprehensiveness of the crisis. So, what to say? Well, to begin with, if I'm allowed to track back to my birth in this lifetime,
sure,
if you will.
Yeah. Mm,
well, I've been blessed to be born on an auspicious day. On a lunar calendar, I was born on the day of Gopastami. What's happening, Sumati?
She said she's not getting sound. Did you poop to the English?
Yeah. Mm.
Clicked on English.
But you can hear me, right? Did
anybody else have trouble hearing on the computer? No. So it's you. I'm sorry.
No problem. Just to give a beginning point, this lifetime I was saying that I was really blessed by being born on the day of Gopastami, which also coincides with the day of Subal, Besh Milan, and the writing of the Mukta Charit of Raghunath Das Goswami, which is interestingly three events that somehow very much eventually will have defined my devotional trajectory. So that's a special mercy that in one way or another I feel has been there for some reason and helped me with solve this or try to solve this comprehensive existential crisis. And of course, regarding how bhakti comes to our life, bhakti is jadricheya. I mean, it comes out of its own will and agency. So, I mean, we should have to ask Bhakti Devi about that, how I came to bhakti. It's about her mercy. But I would say, to begin with, also I received some interesting some scars in the context of spirituality and religion, and this I reply as part of the context of the spiritual existential crisis I mentioned.
Yeah.
My mom wanted to be a nun when she was young, so I always kind of received from her some very much intense like religious impressions, and I had these reminders when I was a kid going to church. And I was kind of in awe in the experience of being in the church and just being there, you know, like attracted to the mystery of it all. You know, for me, it was a pretty mysterious thing to be in these big churches. And of course, it was a more Aishwaric experience, but nonetheless, in connection to something spiritual. So somehow I recall those moments of awe in the face of mystery, and somehow in time, all those will come to the surface and, of course, demand some answer from my side, what to do with the mystery, if you will. And that will be, of course, quite connected with existential crisis in itself. And as I grew as a child, as a teenager, I was pretty much a normal person with my social interactions and so on. But also I enjoyed a lot being by myself, like being alone, reading a lot. and also started to connect more and more as I grew up with artistic sensibilities. I always liked to draw when I was a child also. And started to write. I started to play music, to learn different instruments. And arts was a big portal for me to express my crisis, which I was not yet aware officially that I was in the midst of that, but I was trying to navigate my life through those things. And of course, an interesting point also that on some level defined my trajectory was celibacy. No, I was never like very much inclined towards the prospect of a family and so on. And of course, none of these things are adhikar for bhakti. No, it's not that you have to be brahmachari or to have to be introspective or to have to like to read or to like arts. But somehow, my point is all these elements gradually became more and more apparent that I was, as they say in English, in the road less traveled. No? Like choosing to be in the direction where most of the people was not going. So gradually this started to become part of this existential crisis in the sense of the whole world is going in one direction and I'm being called, somehow I feel I'm called in another direction. When I was like, I don't know, maybe 15 years old, I have some very intense epiphany regarding vegetarianism. One day my mom put a plate of non-vegetarian dishes in front of me and just like internally I went to trouble in my mind when is this coming from, where is this coming from originally. So of course I had to go through my journey through this slaughterhouse and so on. And when I returned, I was like 5 minutes traveling in my mind and returned to the plate. My mom was looking at me, what's going on? And I just pull away the plate and say, I cannot eat this anymore. So from that moment I became vegetarian. Fortunately, my mom, of course, supported me and learned some new recipes and so on. And I would say that in the context of comprehensive existential crisis, a very breaking point was the divorce of my parents. Because I'm an only child, as many of you may know. So, you know, to be an only child has a lot of pros and cons, whatever. For some reason, I'm there. Of course, my mom lost like 3 pregnancies, so I was not supposed to be the only child, but I was destined to be somehow, at least on a physical level, I was the only one. So I was born and I was like raised in a very loving way. I really am appreciative and grateful for what I received from my 2 parents. But somehow you are an only child, and I was the only child, and I was the only grandchild. So many things revolved around basically me as a very little istadev of the family or something like that. So willingly or unwillingly, that creates some comfort zone. And also you are raised in a kind of idyllic, romantic picture of life and reality, being the only child. But eventually divorce created like some breaking point of all that, and many things started to appear and to come into the surface that were already there, but one was not realizing that because of these layers of romanticism, if you will. So it was a very strong, like, coming down to earth and welcome to the real world, if you will. No? and there I was, like, I think 12, 13 years old when that happened, and it was a pretty intense experience. So that took me to lots of suffering. And of course, suffering, I'm grateful to suffering. Suffering took me to want to stop suffering. Of course, that Krishna says one of the 4 people approaching him is the afflicted one. And most of us come from that club, if you will. So I joined spiritual life, or I looked for answers in that connection. So gradually my life started to take some turn. No? When I was like a kid and young teenager, I was also a lot into sports. But with this breaking point of divorce and thing came, I started like to... It was also a breaking point that cracked on reality and showed me new aspects of reality that also I was willing to explore. So I switched from sports to music. I was already into music, but more and more to play, to delve into that universe. And of course, with music come some other elements. You have this famous connection between rock and roll and drugs and sex. In my case, there was no sex. It was that very interesting combination. I was connected to this rock and roll world and the drugs in the context of experiencing like new layers of reality, basically. I never indulged in drugs in the context of, like, I don't know, degrading myself and fighting with other people and breaking stuff or who knows what. But just like discovering, I was discovering, oh, there are other layers to reality than the ones I thought. So through some, of course, I'm not promoting, let's take drugs in that context, but also I know that for some people who may be extremely attached to, I only believe in what I can perceive with my senses, some of those experiences may show them there's something more there. So yeah, if I can track my timeline, it will be sports, rock and roll, and then bhakti, if you will. So eventually this existential crisis in my teenage years, which of course are generally defined by some form of crisis, some transition period, I was not at all identified to having like a normal life, if you will, like study, high school, university, work, house, family, death. If you will, I will like summarize the trajectory in that way. So I was not at all like feeling part of that, but of course not knowing what could I do as an alternative. So I started to read and to study. Meanwhile, I was exploring art and all this. So at one point I thought I may like to study philosophy because I was attracted to philosophy. When I went once to a university of philosophy, and I was kind of idealizing everyone there will be like Socrates and Platon or Plato, and speaking and living philosophy at every step. And of course, that's not the case. And I found more political and relative issues, and philosophy was a theoretical thing, but not so much a lifestyle. So I was kind of frustrated with that. So I was not identify with starting a career. Even at some point I became atheist for some time, at least that was I was telling to myself. but not because I actually was not believing in God, but I was just not satisfied with whatever version of it I had received till that moment, because I would like to inquire in detail about that. I was not very satisfied with what people will tell me about God. So again, there was this deep search for purpose, for meaning. I was not finding meaning in life. It wasn't, and there was no Google at the time to which you put, I have an existential crisis, how to solve it. So, yeah, it may sound like Dwapara Yuga, no internet at the time, but that was the case. So whatever books were there, I tried to grab them. And I was searching a lot through music, but again, especially reading. So I started to read philosophy from the West, which is a very intense experience, reading like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and many others in those directions. Gradually, I started to lean to religion from the West. I went back to the Bible. Then I started to study spirituality from the East, Buddhism, Hinduism, eventually religion, spirituality from India. Every time the search became more and more specific, I will say, no, from West to East, and from East to India, and from India, of course, eventually to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And also, again, going back for one moment to the, and just with this, I'll let you continue with the exchange. The celibacy aspect was also unique because I was not attracted to have family life, but I didn't have a clue about brahmacharya at that time. So I was like kind of overwhelmed or astonished, like, what's going on? And I think I told you once my parents came and told me, darling, no matter which choice you make in your life, we will always love you. So I told them, I'm not gay, you know, because I could feel that was the implication of the question. Of course, I have no problem with homosexuality, but it's not my case. So they were like, okay, so then what's going on? because all of my friends had their partners, so I was the exception to the rule. So, and I told her, I don't know what's going on, I'm trying to figure that out. And of course, when I knew about the possibility of monastic life and the details of that, I really felt, well, that's me. And as I think I also told you once, some years ago when one devotee made me one astrological chart for some health issues, at one point he told me, Maharaj, you have the perfect chart for the sannyasi. You have Venus, which is the planet of romance, in the worst possible position. So romanticism is not for you in this land. And I told him, yes, I'm sure I know that. Thanks for the further confirmation, if you will. So some ideas in connection to all this idea of finding my own identity and going through this existential crisis. So.
Yeah, wow. Well, we're grateful that your mother didn't become a nun. That's the first thing. And probably her thoughts about becoming a nun probably helped her. I would imagine it helped her to be okay with your direction.
Yeah, I would say so. That she totally supports me. That's totally clear. As I've made it clear many times, she always expressed how happy and grateful she is for the path I've chosen. And as I always tell, she once told me very nicely, spontaneously, someday you return back home here, I will send you right back immediately to the temple. I know that's your place. I know that's you there. And I say, yes, I hope that will never happen, but just in case, you know what to do. So thank you for that.
Yeah. So you were going through this major existential crisis for, it sounds like, a number of years that was kind of brewing and developing. And you had a lot of clues in your early life that indicated that you weren't meant for the ordinary course of activities. Actually, Krishna says that in the Gita, just anyone who doesn't depend on the ordinary course of activities is very dear to me. So you were very dear to Krishna coming in, and obviously had been a bhakta for probably at least your last lifetime for sure, and made a lot of advancement. So from here, how did you come in contact with the devotees? How did you find your path? How did that take place?
Well, as I told you, I was already studying and reading, and everything became more and more specific in time in the direction of India and the direction of, and eventually, of course, of bhakti. Of course, I've met devotees throughout my lifetime. When I was younger, you always have these memories of devotees in the street chanting or seeing someone shaven with orange robes and so on. But more specifically, I remember meeting one devotee who eventually I knew. He was a disciple of Bhaktivedanta Swami. Mm-hmm. He was distributing books. So I was maybe that time like 16 years or something. So I was right in the midst of my crisis, which was basically from 13 to 19, basically. And he was distributing books, and he gave me one, Perfection of Yoga. And I didn't have money to pay to him. And I told him, and he gave me the book as a gift. So that created some impression in me. Oh, these guys are here not for the money. So, wow, they want to share this message. They have this ideal, this commitment with the ideal. So I appreciated that. Although I read the book, and it was not like yet an epiphany for me. But then I have one friend of mine who lives now in Spain, with whom we have two music. We play music together in different projects. He played bass, and I played drums in one band. And also he learned bansuri or bamboo flute, and I learned tabla, which is Indian percussion. And we used to do lots of musical thing, but also we used to speculate a lot philosophically. We used to get together and just think about life and speak about, because the two of us were really looking for meaning and purpose. And eventually he became a Vaishnava. He was the first, if I'm not mistaken, first initiated disciple of Srila Narayan Maharaj in Argentina. Chaitanya Krishna Das, that's his name now, in case he's watching this or whatever. And in case it's not, no problem. And we were once reading one book by Joseph Campbell, which is pretty interesting because I know that your interviews kind of follow his structure of the hero's journey. So we were reading one book of his, not his their main ones, The Hero of the Thousand Masks and so on, but we were reading one book that he was just speaking about myths from East. And there were different chapters dedicated to different deities, if you will. So there was one chapter dedicated to Krishna. And in that chapter, the Damodar Lila was described. So we didn't have a clue. I didn't connect this is the same person that this perfection of yoga was pointing to. So we read this book, and we both especially liked that chapter. Krishna, wow, nice, attractive, charming, Damodar Lila. How could it not be so? So we said to each other, if you find something else about Krishna, you let me know. Remember, there was no internet at the time, although it sounds like previous age. So so eventually I was in a, visiting one friend of mine, and she was living with her mother, and her mother has different books on the shelf, so I always try to gravitated in those directions. And I read Bhagavad Gita, and I found this sounds weird, so I was interested in that, therefore. So I opened the book, and I saw all these illustrations of the Dehinasmin Yatadehe, the transmigration of the soul, and these images with it looked like, wow, this is interesting. It seemed a little psychedelic, and I always like all this psychedelic stuff, so I said, that this must be interesting. So I asked the book, I borrowed the book, and I realized, oh, Krishna. Krishna, it is connected with this Damodar Lila. So I called my friend and told him, I found something more about Krishna, if you want to read it. Because I was at the time reading, I was reading Aldo Huxley, I think, The Island, after Brave New World, so whatever. So I gave the book to my friend, so he started reading the book, and started going to the temple, which at that time was a temple from, the temple he visited and eventually I visited was from the Brinda Mission. And he read the whole book, and I finished my own books. And when I was finished, he gave me the Bhagavad Gita as it is. It was Srila Prabhupada's version, edition. And that was an epiphany, I can tell you. Bhagavad Gita as it is came and basically, yeah, saved my life, I could say. I mean, gave answers to all the questions I had, and also gave answers to questions I was not asking to myself. But that I realized I should have been asking myself these questions as well. So I read the whole thing, I don't know, maybe in 2 days or something. I practically devoured the book because I was so thirsty for answers. And remember my friends calling me, come here, no, I'm busy. And I continued, come here, no. And I was just like reading. And when I finished the book, I called my friend, the one who gave me the book, who read it first, actually. I gave it to him. And I told him, where is the people who is practicing this? Because also some apprehension came, like, okay, this is so nice, but I wonder if there's anyone practicing this. Because if I do not see I was attracted to bhakti through the philosophy, but almost immediately, I mean, I needed to see the practicality, the common sense, the application of that. So I called my friend and he told me, he was funny. He told me, I was just waiting for this call. I knew you were calling me and telling me this. So I'll take you to the temple tomorrow. So basically I went to the temple the next day, and the temple happened to be like 15 blocks from where I was living. And it was a place that always I was walking through, but I never realized there was a temple. It was on the first floor, so I never knew. So I started to go, and parallel to that, interestingly, as I mentioned, I was playing tabla, and I was studying tabla with a teacher, and he was also a Gaudiya Vaishnava, he is, but I never realized that. This, again, in time, I started like to connect the dots, basically. No? So, this book here, this book that the devotee gave me at one point, and so on. So basically, I started to go to the temple every single day. Because at that time I was not studying, I was kind of in a sabbatic year, teaching English and teaching drum lessons or something, but relatively free. So I was going every day to the temple in the morning, staying till evening, going back to sleep. Next day to the temple, all day till evening, going back to sleep. Till at one point came this idea, I'd like to go and live in the ashram, basically. No? Because meeting the devotees for me, of course, was a further confirmation, no, of the book. No? Meeting the book Bhagavat, if you will, and the devotee Bhagavat. So I needed to see this is practically applicable in life, and there's people living this philosophy as a lifestyle. I mean, I need that. I was looking for that. So when I entered the temple the first time, I had also a very epiphany-like moment walking the stairs. It was the first floor. And very overwhelming emotion that this is home. No, you are coming home. You are entering your home. It was like totally, I mean, I cannot put it in words. It's totally clear for me. Like, and it was similar to what I felt while reading the Gita. And a few days after, sorry to mention this, I mean, not sorry, but sorry to extend myself maybe too much.
No, not at all.
But it comes to mind a third epiphany. No, first one was reading the Gita, second one was entering temple for the first time, and third one was I was chanting Hari Nam. I didn't have a japa mala of tulsi beads, but I made myself a japa mala with string, the string that you put the clothes to dry. So I was living in a flat, and on the rooftop there was like this thing for all the members of the flat to put their clothes to dry. So I'm sorry to confess this now, 23 years after. Hopefully I won't be demanded. But I went and cut that string. Now, one of them, not all. And I make knots on that. And I was not able to do 108 because I will take in the whole string. It will be like a Damodar Lila taking all the rope from Braj. But I made one with 54. So I reached half of the total. And I would chant with that like two times. And that was one round, if you will. And with that type of japa mala, if you will, I also had a very undeniable epiphany moment chanting Srinam. Like, again, I cannot put it in words, but it was like totally overwhelming how Krishna revealed to me while chanting in my room, in my house, with that little piece of string. And totally confirming, further confirming, if you will, my journey, my trajectory, yeah.
It's really, yeah, inspiring.
And yes, of course.
Yeah.
I was really inspired. Yeah.
I had that epiphany too when I went to the temple that this is home, but I also had something at the same time of, I don't want this to be home. This is too weird. So I had a conflicting, but Krishna said, no, it's home. You have to stay. It wasn't easy, but I was convinced that, okay, this is,
yeah,
you this end, is the way I have to go. I didn't want it to look like this. That was my...
You ended up being weird, no problem.
And I'm so glad. And I just, you know, more and more weird people like you that come into my life, it's like, yeah, this is the right place to be, for sure. So you made it into the temple, and you very easily took to a committed practice. It seems like that there wasn't really a problem with taking up the sadhana and the principles, the not upgraded 2.0 regular principles, but the original version of the regular principles.
Stop promoting my lectures, please, Archie.
Oh, I love it. So is that true that it was that you took to it pretty easily? There wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, of course there were. Yeah, there were some in between challenges in the sense of how to say. I was having this like very raging, passionate desire. I want to go to live in an ashram. But I have some few commitments, if you will, in the outside world. I have two music bands, and we have just recorded some an album, and we were projecting, okay, we will live by doing music. And I had to tell them, okay, I'm leaving the band and I'm going to live to an ashram as a monk, which sounded for them like, you are totally crazy. I mean, for them it was, we knew you were already weird, because they could see me and they knew me in my search and in my crisis and looking for things that they were not interested at the time. So I was already a little bit weird. But when I told them, that was like, okay, that officially confirmed that you are totally weird. So, I mean, they were, yeah, I understand. I mean, it was not, I mean, we were just, after years of working and struggling trying to make a living out of music, and we were start to get in it, and I'm leaving the thing at that moment, basically, no? But eventually, in time, they understood, and some of them are connected, and we are friends, and they actually start to inquire on another level after some years of experiences as well. And I remember, but there are very different things in between. But yeah, I was so much determined that I want to go to an ashram. So at one point, they told me, "Even we have to make some concert, like a farewell concert, one last concert with you." And I was like, I didn't want, but I say, okay, I understand we have to close the chapter. So I went and I said, well, but the two bands in the same night, because I don't want too many things. And those concerts are very late. And the devotees were telling me, better do not go. It's dangerous. They may offer you who knows what to take. And I knew that would happen, but I was really determined. I mean, I know they will offer me whatever, but I just want to close this chapter and open my new chapter. And it was like that. And I remember that night there were people offering some beer, some pot to smoke. I said, no, no, thank you. No, no, thank you. But why? And they were like, I said, we can continue our relationship with that in the midst of us. And I was really determined. And people was in the audience shouting, why are you leaving? You should continue. And all these type of things. But I just wanted to close the chapter, no? And of course, as you may also know, when I wanted to go, I felt this strong need of give myself to the ideal. I felt I cannot embrace such a comprehensive ideal in a half-baked way. No, I want to give myself fully to the ideal. In that way, this could only give meaning to my life. No, I want to have full meaning. So yeah, I felt I had to go to the ashram. I remember the day I went to the ashram to ask the devotee, the senior devotee in charge, about if he could allow me to go to the ashram. I was so, like, not nervous, but just thinking, and what if he says no? I mean, I couldn't, like, conceive what will I do with my life if I don't have that opportunity. And I was so much, like, in anxiety. If he says no, I mean, basically, I don't know how to continue with my life. And if he says yes, of course, that's my life there, no? So, of course, fortunately, he said yes. Of course, when I told that to my mom also, that was a little bit of an interesting dynamics, because, as you may know, she was going at that time to a church, Christian church, which was pretty, like, narrow-minded. So they told him that I was entering a cult, they were brainwashing me, and I was becoming a demon or who knows what. And I started, meanwhile, going to the temple, and every day I came back to the temple with some new items, some deities, some picture. The next day I went, that thing disappeared, or she told me it was broken. And after many days of stuff disappearing, I told mom, what's going on? I mean, tell me. And she started, of course, crying and telling me, I love you and I'm afraid of you, afraid what may happen to you. These people, the people in the church are telling me this or that. And I told him, no, that's not like this. You see me becoming like satanized or demoniac? And she told me, no, I see you much better than ever. So I told her, yeah, come to me to the temple and you yourself see for yourself and ask whatever you want. I won't intervene. So fortunately, she agreed. She was very happy with the experience in the temple. And then the people from the church called her and say, so what happened? Because they knew. She told, no, they're very nice people. And they told her, no, 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 they are not nice people. They are all bad people. And if you think they are good people, you will go to hell with them. So she put the phone off and told me, now I've realized which was the cult, actually. And she started from that day on to visit the temple, Sunday feast, became vegetarian, it's like a devotee without officially being initiated, if you will, no? So those are some of the little, if you want to call them, challenges or obstacles in the path of yeah, going to the ashram. But
yeah, breaking away from the world.
Yeah,
the bands were really, that was that you took to music as like something really important. So that was breaking away and disappointing them. You were probably the lead singer. You probably wrote all the music. Played every instrument. Is that true?
I was not the lead singer. I was the drummer in one, and I was the guitar player in the other, but I was mostly the one who wrote all the music.
All the music, yeah. That's pretty important service for the van. I can imagine they probably didn't continue after you left, did they?
Yeah, whatever. But they understood in time, and they were, I mean, in the moment it was shocking, but eventually they appreciated and they valued my commitment with whatever I felt it was like valuable and worthy of pursuing. And until today, of course, from that moment till today, I feel that this idea of commitment to the ideal is everything. And I remember in this connection once I asked Guru Maharaj, like, which service can I do that will please you the most? And he told me, try to increase your commitment with the ideal. So I was almost in ecstasy by hearing that reply. Of course, that's totally challenging, and that's forever, service forever, instruction for life. But it was right to the point. Try to increase your commitment with your ideal. Mm. Similar to what Srila Semara said, try to change your angle of vision, basically. No?
Yeah.
So that was kept me there till now, I would say, no? The healthy sense of committing with such a noble and deep ideal we have received.
So you started your practice, and then, like, we've been looking at the Joseph Campbell paradigm, and how that the challenges that come are actually there to help us enhance, increase, mm-hmm. upgrade, as you use that word a lot. I love that word. Mm-hmm. Upgrade our bhakti. So what were some of the early challenges? Well, maybe not just early, but going forward, that really have impacted you, and what you saw, the positive growth from those challenges?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I will say that in the very beginning of my devotional life, I wouldn't say there were not challenges, but I was not perceiving them. I mean, there are always challenges. The point is how much you are aware of them. So in the beginning, I was in my kind of bhakti honeymoon. So just romanticizing all the experience. I'm quite naive. And I mean, I was really young. I joined the ashram when I was 19. So I was brahmachari. And again, I was very happy being a brahmachari. And at that time, I was mostly traveling and distributing books for the first years. It was mostly main service, traveling, distributing books, or not traveling, but distributing books. And also in between, worshipping the deity and some other things, like I mentioned, and cooking and cleaning and so on. But eventually, after the naive period, if you will, the honeymoon ended, I started gradually to awake to the reality that, okay, devotees are also human beings with their own struggles. They are not, as I say, devotional superheroes. And they are not all as I have idealized them in the beginning. So I start to awake to that reality and having to deal more and more with relationships. And of course, by realizing that was the case in them, that start to realize that was the case in me as well. Mm-hmm. Because somehow you project, okay, now I'm a devotee, now I'm here in the ashram and distributing books, and we are all kind of in this like transcendental bubble and nothing is affecting us. But then you realize, no, that's not as true, that true. And that's affecting them, but as a reflection, that's going on with me as well. So I start to wake up with that, to awaken to that, to deal more and more with relationships and the complexities of any relationship, starting with one's relationship with oneself. And in time, I was not traveling that much, and I started to take more responsibilities, if you will, in other areas, like taking charge of being responsible for ashrams, like temple president or doing some management, which is not my nature, but the need was there. So one tries to, of course, to adapt to the necessity of the moment. And lots of investment in relationships and dealing with people and communicating and learning the arts of that, and knowing each other and relationships. So I somehow became a psychologist without officially going through the title and all that it entails to be a psychologist, because so much work invested into others' mind and how to understand and be... I'm not saying I'm perfect in that at all, but somehow
you're
I've
very,
been
very good in that area.
I've been thrown into that direction by force, probably because that was what I needed to work on the most.
Yeah,
so yeah, gradually again, the natural challenge of awakening to many of my own limitations and anarthas, not only about the environment, but especially like trying to, in time, dedicate more and more the focus on changing myself. In the beginning, again, it was the naive, let's go on outside and save the world and preach and transform every and convert every single atom that comes on our way. And eventually trying directing that emphasis more like, no, let's change myself and convert myself and develop a healthy stance to acknowledge my shortcomings without over-identifying with them. I mean, still on that process, that's an ongoing thing. And also in the context of that, of course, I must mention that I have a very unique, blessed opportunity to live very closely with certain Vaishnavas that I really love, and I'm very close friends of mine, like Vaishnava Maharaj or Govinda Dasi, and others, which are Gauramrita Dasi, which I've lived with them for almost 20 years and living really close together, not always in the same ashram per se, but working closely together for more than 2 decades. So with all its pros and cons, in the sense of mostly pros, but always there are challenges in relationships and in really getting to know someone to that point, you know, it's kind of a marriage, if you will. So that was very, very nice. I'm so totally grateful for that experience that still keeps developing, although now I'm in the dynamics of not staying too much physically close to them, but we are, of course, continue with our relationship in a very substantial way. And in time, let's say, with this I'm speaking just after 10, 15 years of practice, gradually myself as well as Vaishnava Maharaj, for sure, we had a very particular way of being and emphasizing, and we were always very much identified with sadhana and studying shastra and trying to practice, you know, and trying to identify with being a sadhaka. So gradually the mood of in the mission we were in at that time were quite different apart from us. And the emphasis were more on relative things and relative ways of preaching and external expansion. So we were feeling more and more the need of the change. Eventually we received the opportunity to open a new mission, like an outshoot of that bring the mission, and that mission is called Bhakti Alok. So we opened that with all the challenges that entail, and many devotees from the former mission thinking we abandoned the other mission, we abandoned the guru, we want to be gurus ourselves, and all those type of things, and all that entails starting something from, in one sense, from scratch. But it was a very important chapter also, where we have our place and time and way of doing things. But interestingly, after some years passed in that new, more favorable situation, I was personally still, I was going to another existential crisis, if you will, interestingly, because I felt that I needed a different life situation, if you will, a different dynamics according to my nature and according to what I felt I could contribute to the Gaudiya community. I was kind of feeling, I'm not blaming Bhakti Alok or any of its members or nothing like that, but just I was not fully fitting into the dynamics of that situation and mission. And also, to have the capacity of myself accepting that and not feeling, oh, I'm feeling bad because I'm being selfish, or I'm in Maya, or I'm ungrateful for this new situation, but just I needed some changes according to the situation I was in, to my own nature. And of course, on top of that, and maybe, of course, there's not that much time to enter into details of this, but as you may know, there was a lot of difficult situation with my former guru that created also a lot of weird dynamics. Even although we were in a separate mission and somehow we were protected from that, he was nonetheless our guru. So how to accommodate with that, how to deal with that. So all that also kind of fostered my need for a change and new life dynamics. So somehow that was connected with my connection, my shelter with Guru Maharaj, basically, whom I knew him from already. I knew him from day one, basically, because at that time when I joined the ashram in 1999, He was a vice president of the Vishwa Vaishnava Rakshava called World Vaishnava Association. The president was Bhakti Pramod Puri Maharaj. And so I knew about Guru Maharaj's existence. I read some articles a few years after I was with the Sangha newsletter. And I met him for the first time in 2007 in Vrindavan, where I had the chance of rendering some service to him by translating his lectures. So that was kind of a prophetic seva that will come back to me after some years. And I got as much books as I could from him at that time. So I read first Sikshastakam and I blew my mind. And I continued with the other ones. So I started to have correspondence with him. And he became, in time, my main guru figure. I mean, he was my Siksha guru at the time. But I called him Guru Maharaj. And he was like my most prominent guru figure in my life. So, of course, eventually in time, as the relationship developed, and I visited him in Anudarya and other places, when all these other things happened with my former guru, for me it was like a very organic, natural choice to take shelter in Guru Maharaj. I'm summarizing a lot here.
that's the thing. These interviews, you know, your whole life, you did an hour and some minutes, you know. I was just thinking, you know, when you were saying you went through another existential crisis, and I was just thinking about how an existential crisis it's an internal calling to say you need to be doing something different. Mm-hmm. And you had that, you know, at 13 to 19 and then again in the temple, because you weren't. You were ready to move on to another service. Krishna had another plan for you to go in a certain way. And so that feeling of, you know, all the things that come with an existential crisis, you know, just not feeling, you know, maybe feeling empty or hopeless or, you know, or all those feelings help to open door, you know, allow us to see that there's other doors. Otherwise, we, you know, complacency, we would just stay kind of in our comfort zone. Is it, you're always trying to push the devotees out of their comfort zone. One of your services to all of us.
Krishna is pushing me out of the comfort zone very expertly. So I'm trying to extend that opportunity to others.
You're just really rightly situated, so it seems, doing the traveling that you're doing and, you know, speaking and writing, it's just such a perfect, at least it appears to be the perfect fit for you.
I mean, at least at the moment, again, I'm not saying I won't have any other crisis and Krishna may have another plan. I'm open to that also, but I agree with what you say. Crisis is not necessarily a bad word. I mean, when I say crisis, I'm not saying something wrong. I'm saying, as you mentioned, new portal, new chapter.
Just thinking it's exciting new adventure, and I guess trying to help the devotees to understand how, you know, crisis and really challenging, difficult situations, to help us embrace them instead of be afraid of them or, you know, think there's something wrong. And I think that's one of the things, at least for myself, that I really hope devotees, it's a takeaway from listening to all of these interviews.
I think to take that step and make that embrace of the challenging, paradoxical, unknown prospect that knocks on our door, that's what makes real difference between becoming like external devotees, if you will, and internal devotees, to really grow and mature and make our bhakti something alive and part of our existence, is to not be afraid of that and develop the necessary courage to trust, as I like to say, that Krishna is doing his job. That's our job. No? Our job is to trust that Krishna is doing his job. So, So he's protecting us. He will protect me. He's maintaining me. And I have trust that that's a fact, whatever form it takes. So I have to learn to see that and to just accept the invitation, basically. The clarion call, as Guru Maharaj likes to put it. Whatever it may come from.
Yeah, so just kind of fast forwarding to your current life, which is seems to be a very good fit, and you're connecting with some wonderful devotees from all the sanghas, it seems like, and well loved and accepted, and little 3-year-olds making signs for your door telling you that you can, this is your room now. By the way, it's just, it's very endearing. So yeah. I'm curious, this new, I mean, it is relatively, all the travel and outreach is relatively a new, I mean, you've been doing it all along, but you're really doing it now. So what, how, I mean, I'm sure there are some challenges to it. And, you know, I mean, just traveling in itself is hardship on the body. So what have the challenges been in this new lifestyle and service?
Yeah, that's a good question, yeah. Because externally it may sound like, oh, I'm traveling, touring the world, and I'm just receiving one ticket after another, and that's just having fun, and that's all. But actually, as you mentioned, I think this is a grace of Guru Maharaj. He opened me so many doors. Also, you are to blame because of many doors that have opened for you, and Nittai, and New York, and so on. So, but I'm very, very happy to have that chance because I've always been inspired to serve devotees in an inter-sangha context, not only limited to one particular affiliation. That's one of the main things I'm grateful for my former guru. From day one, he opened me the doors to the whole Gaudiya constellation. So I was accustomed to grow, knowing about all these different sadhus and acharyas and moods. So for me, it has been always been natural and inspiring. And I like to continue serving, although I have, of course, main service in connection to my Guru Maharaj and his Sangha. Part of what Guru Maharaj tries to share is goes beyond his Sangha, if you will, and tries to address the whole Gaudiya community. And he himself makes it clear. So, yeah, I find myself in this new dynamics for the last 2 years, and probably for many to come. Let's see. It was not in my plan, so I don't want also like to project, condition something according to what Krishna may want. So I'm kind of, and I have to, it's challenging because of course I'm not someone who has like very strong physical health, like super healthy and super strong. So I need also to calculate how to, my movements as to remain alive, as to make that sustainable. And as you can imagine, I'm traveling to many places, but I'm not traveling to every place that I've received an invitation to go. Because if that would be the case, I may spend 3 days in every different city and country, and that would be too much. Not only, I mean, to begin physically, but on so many other levels as well, mentally and emotionally and spiritually. I'm a person who needs to have one's own place for introspection and prayer and practice. I'm not willing to sacrifice my sadhana for the sake of traveling, for example. And I think that's something that really has helped me to go from day one till now, that I have been always, hopefully not attached in a number way, but attached to always chant my rounds and always spend certain amount of time per day for whatever, prachar, study, and so on. And I think that has been a huge blessing. And I don't want to sacrifice that at the present. On the contrary, hopefully to increase that in quantity, quality. So I think that traveling a lot, of course, means you are constantly changing scenarios, different climates, different psychologies, different cultures, which on one side is very interesting because you have to adapt a lot. And that creates lots of flexibility, if you will. But also it's important to keep what's your ideal in mind, what's your mood in mind, what's your type of way of serving others in mind, because if not, it can become like too many influences coming every single day and you end up nowhere in a type of hodgepodge limbo. So it's important for me to have those moments where I can really go deep into how I want to do things, how I want to serve my Guru Maharaj, how I need to be, and so on. What else? Well, of course, to travel that much, you are always, it's in one sense, a very big blessing. You are surrounded by devotees at every moment. But on one side, you are pretty much by yourself. basically. You are alone, basically, in one sense. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I like to be alone. For me, it's okay. I mean, I'm not recommending this life dynamics almost to anyone. You have to have a very specific, if you will, framework of identity, and it fits for me. But I need also to keep in touch with intimate connection with well-wishers and friends that I know a lot, because if not, it can become a little bit like, how to say, you can be distracted, and so many people you can imagine that you met in these journeys do not actually get to know you that deeply and may over-idealize you and see you for a week and you are, again, an avatar almost or something. So you deal with an overdose of kijais, as I like to put it. Yeah. So one needs to balance that with humanity and constructive criticism, and those things you may receive them from close people who really know you, and it's important to keep in touch with those connections, because that really gives balance to all the experience that you are having traveling here and there. And for some people, you are kind of a rock star, devotional rock star or something. And I don't want that to happen, no? In the name of giving something, so trying to give something so noble and so deep, trying to misrepresent that through my own deviation and distraction and give something distorted. And I'm not saying I'm giving something totally pure, but at least as much as I can be aware, I would like to properly represent my guardians, my well-wishers. So I would say those are some of the main challenges. Of course, in the midst of these dynamics, I also sometimes need to stop for a while, for some months in one place, like in India or like in some other place, to really ground in some other experiences and maybe stop preaching that much and going more into my own practice and studies, or if I will, I was thinking, speaking yesterday with the devotees regarding writing another book project that is already in mind, and how much would I be able to do that while traveling constantly? I'm not too sure. I may need to get stuck for another 6 months, like it happened when I was there with you in North Carolina. Let's see. No?
But yeah, that's what I was going to say. You can always come here for a retreat and we won't invite anybody.
Yeah, and I'm very blessed because I've been in three places till now in the U.S. in this last tour. And all those three places, the devotees have told me exactly the same thing. Maharaj, if you need a writing retreat, you can come here and stay.
Just come here.
So
if you can.
That's humbling. No, I'm fortunate. I'm fortunate to feel how Krishna is really, again, protecting and nourishing and extending affection through the Vaishnava. That's really humbling. So that helps to keep oneself sober in the midst of such a situation of being the center in one sense, in the eyes of others. All these humbling experiences really balance the equation.
I think it was Maya Angelou. She had a statement that something like, I belong everywhere, but I belong nowhere. But at the same time, I belong nowhere. So I was thinking a sannyas like does kind of, I mean, a sannyas is like this, like that. Or any devotee who's dedicating their lives to, trying to. I mean, we can even be in one place and have that feeling that I belong everywhere.
I appreciate your point, because of course if you are traveling too much and you are not dealing with that properly, that can be really dysfunctional to your sense of identity and belonging and who I am or where do I belong to. Am I totally like fractured sense of self? And some people will say, no, stay in one place and settle yourself there and root yourself there. But also there is this opportunity of being everywhere and at the same time feeling a sense of belonging, universal belonging, if you will. Like, and that's the idea, eventually, for all of us, to not limit our sense of identity and belonging to one house, one family, one country, one place, but more and more universal terms. So I feel that's a very nice blessing. Of course, it's a challenge. It's not that easy, but it's necessary at the end of the day for actually every one of us, not only a sannyasi, even, no?
Exactly. Yeah, so I would just kind of looking at our time, and I want to maybe just What do you see as being the most profound changes in yourself since you've started this path?
Well, difficult to tell because, I mean, bhakti performs miracles in so many levels. So many things can be said, not again out of pride, but out of hopefully real humility, appreciation for bhakti. I think a real humility has to do with accepting this, no? That I have changed and so many miracles are happening in my life, but it's not me the main character in this, no? So I would say in that context that, I don't know, one of the most profound changes have been a huge degree of emotional maturity that came through some of the most difficult challenges that came to my life. I have gone through so many of those difficult moments and lots of suffering, but lots of, if you will, forced humility and learning and and having to integrate, as I know you like this idea, integration of complexity, trying to put all these pieces together, and that gave us a result so much more nuanced and deep sense of being and identity and fearlessness, which I think is so crucial for one to be alive, basically, to face whatever has to come in life. If you are not fearless, you will be just like Sila Samar said, you will be paralyzed by fear and doubt. So I've been gifted with, I will say, with that, with experience of with this maturity, and it's still, again, ongoing process, work in progress, and experience of deep and committed relationships and a taste for that, a very deep taste for deep and committed relationships, and realizing how much I am a byproduct of that, of that environment, and how much I do want to remain a byproduct of that. And how much a real deep committed relationship, which of course will become as such after so many difficulties and harmonizing in between, that really gives so much gift and so much like power, empowerment to one's spiritual project. So, I mean, I could go on and on with so many things that I feel bhakti has given me in terms of transformation, yeah. But I will point in those directions a little bit.
Yeah, and it's just really, I think, beautiful to hear a sannyasi speaking about committed relationships, because, you know, a lot of times we think, oh, committed relationship, you know, you have to be in the grihastha ashram for that, and probably in some ways, you know, it's just beautiful to hear you speak about that, because there is just so much, you know, that happens in a committed relationship of showing us, you know, mirroring for us to see where we're really at. And you can't get that if you're not in relationship, right? It seems.
Yeah, I remember I spoke recently in one podcast with Jai Jagannath Prabhu and Karuna Avatar on monasticism, and I was mentioning this point that I think that many sannyasis have not been able to sustain their vows because of lack of committed relationship, and not with the opposite sex, of course, but of intimacy, no? Of expressing even sexual energy as creative energy, and creative energy having to do also with sexual experience, having to do with intimacy. And intimacy is not only limited to sexual energy. So as a sannyasi, also I need intimacy, but that doesn't mean that I need a partner, if you will. I need just committed relationships, you know, so deep connection with people, and that will give so much support that, of course, you will be able to sustain your vows. To be a sannyasi doesn't mean that you are not relating with anyone, at least not in our bhakti mark. That's not the way we approach that as sannyasis, because at the end of the day, we are not even sannyasis. We want to be bhaktas and servants of the bhaktas and friends with the devotees. So I really think that that's crucial for any ashram, any varna, any ashram, to really maintain yourself humanly sober and not go crazy, basically. What to speak of sustaining your vows.
So one
thing in this connection, that also this type of experiences and gift from bhakti, I think, those have also made me be much more at peace with myself, and also much more at peace with trying to focus, as Guru Maharaj will say, with making progress and not in the need of converting others or convincing others and even not concerned about what every single person may think or feel about me, because in one point of my life that has happened, in the sense of I start to become more and more of a public figure, and you know, being a public figure on some level, it entails this type of interactions and opinions and social media and whatnot. So trying to develop a healthy stance in that connection, and not being indifferent, but just trying to understand, to be open to those opinions that come from a constructive place. And if that's not happening, basically life goes on and I have to remain focused on the important stuff, basically.
Yeah. Wonderful. And just as kind of like a closing point, maybe just some advice that you would give to our viewers, devotees, as far as treading the Bhakti Marg, and you know, you've said so many things, but just to maybe grab out the essence. Beautiful advice that I know that you can churn out of it all.
Yeah, it will be easier to send some links of YouTube lectures there, but right. As you mentioned, almost every class, I try at least to make every class as a form of that advice, but of course we can say something. I don't know, I will emphasize it in a very simple way, but at the same time, something I consider very important, the dialogue as basis of any relationship, and be careful with proper communication in your interactions, because that's so crucial to remaining being personalists and not becoming impersonalists. We are so much about personalism in our Bhakti Marg, but we have to reflect that in how we relate to others and how much quality time we spend in taking care of our communication and dialogue. Because without that, devotional project will become, I don't know, superficial, fictitious even. What else? No matter how hard it gets, Krishna is always protecting you. So don't forget that. I mean, we were speaking about that yesterday with Lalita Sakhi, that we know Krishna is always in control. We know Krishna is protecting that us always. But sometimes we forget. We become distracted from that reality. So in those moments that we have a cloudy day, we basically have to switch back to that particular focus and remember that thing that remains there. Krishna is doing his job. He's always protecting me. Actually, he's protecting me more than what I can imagine. And of course, what can I do to reciprocate? No, not when I say Krishna, this extends to Sri Guru and the Vaishnavas. So the blessings and the mercy that is coming to our life goes beyond our wildest imagination. And sometimes it goes so much beyond what we can imagine that protection is perceived by us as non-protection. Because we may idealize Krishna will protect me in this way, but he's protecting me in such a much more comprehensive way that it takes another shape, and we misread that another shape and feel, oh, this is dangerous. And we may pray to Krishna for protection, and he's actually protecting us.
That's a beautiful point.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
What else? Something, yeah, we depend on others, the well-wishing of others and the affection of others more than we can conceive as well. So try to secure well-wishing and affection from Vaishnavas. Try to win the heart of the Vaishnavas in a sincere way, because you need it, we need it. And of course, no matter how much mercy and grace we have received, we have to continue working every single day. We have to every single day reaffirm our vows, our commitments with our ideal. That's our job. Again, Krishna is doing his job, but our job is to, on every single day, that's what it means to practice sadhana every day, not just to do stuff mechanically, but to reaffirm my inner convictions, to update them, upgrade the depth of my commitments. And in this way, I will be continuing growing in a progressive way till reaching the goal, and when you reach the goal, so much growth will be waiting from that on also, no? So some ideas.
Really wonderful. So anything you'd like to say about your current travels and your book and how it's being received? And
Fortunately the book has been received very nicely. Of course, there has been in every place I've been some also challenges in the healthy way. Devotees like being a little bit like challenged by the content, but fortunately willing to speak and interact. And it's very wonderful also to see that process of transformation in a few days, devotees that are having certain stance, and not about that they accept bhakti is inherent or not inherent, but just to open themselves to things can be different, and to be open to deconstruct some notions they carried for decades, and be willing to embrace a more nuanced perspective. For me to witness that is like magic, and I'm humbled by being instrumental in something of that. So I'm happy to contribute from that side to the life of the Vaishnavs. And so in that sense, it's very nice. Now I'm in Kansas for one more week, and then I'll be going back to North Carolina for 3 more weeks, and so on. Michigan, eventually over there, Alaska, then Europe, then Central America, then maybe India, and so on. See you somewhere. See you soon, or see you Zoom, as we say nowadays.
So we have just a few more minutes. Maybe we can open up for questions.
Yeah.
Anyone on the call has a question? Well, we've got Indra. She's all excited. You have to unmute yourself there.
Hare Krishna, Pranav. Yes, I'm very excited. Like, thank you so much for this interview series. And Hare Krishna Maharaj. So I'm just going to make it quick. I think what's really on my mind is, what were the names of your bands and where can we get the records?
I think there's... I can reply the first part of the question, basically. The first part, the names of the bands, what was called... I mean, that was a word we created, so that's not... There's no specific meaning. But the name of the band was Inavya. So that was a word that... A band that I played drums on. And the name of the band had a subtitle, something like The Revenge of Nature, or something like that. And the second band was called Harmony. So that's and not technically the same way like you pronounce it in English, but basically that was the idea conveyed, harmony. So that's, of course, a word that I still carry with me and very important. And regarding the where to get the albums, I don't have a clue, to be honest. I mean, I don't have them with me, and I don't know if there may be anywhere. But and I wouldn't recommend you to hear them, so it's okay, no problem. Continue with the nice music you are doing and the kirtans you may be hearing.
Hare Krishna. I was wondering, so the songs, were they more like of philosophical nature, or, I mean, generic love songs? Or
no,
maybe
no,
you can
no.
talk about this, and also if you are still writing songs. Thank you.
Well, generic love songs has, as I told you, romanticism is not on my chart, so that's not happening. So yeah, most of them were all of them were totally into the existential crisis and philosophy, and trying to deal with all that stuff. Some of them were in English, some of them were in Spanish. And if I have written other things, yeah, actually during my time with the devotees, I've had like 3 different bands. I didn't mention that one. So, and in one of them, I continue playing in my brahmachari times. I play drums in one, I play guitar in another, I play tabla in another, and we recorded like different albums with each one of them. Now as a sannyasi, I'm not doing that anymore. Not because of some forced thing, but I just don't feel that. I mean, my creativity has taken the direction of writing. I mean, before I also wrote, but the prominence changed now, switched. And of course, I continue trying to express myself, even musically, when we sing kirtans and bhajans. But yeah, I've written songs. There are songs that are written there that have never even been recorded. But yeah, more now the creative energy, Kriya Shakti, is flowing through the writing process, or even like giving lectures. For me, it's like a creative experience, you know, trying to express and share thoughts. And there's musicality in it as well.
So maybe you can write a theme song for your book.
Let's see.
That would be creative.
I'm trying to invest all my creativity. In the last book, I really invested lots of creativity. So I don't know if there's something left for writing a song for it. Let's see.
It would probably, that would go viral for sure. Any other questions from the devotees that are on the call? Okay, well, looks like there's no other questions, so I'm just really grateful to have you come on, and your kindness for giving us your time and your precious time, and it's getting more and more precious these days. So thank you so much. It was beautiful, and so many really, really nice points that you brought out. And yeah, thank you for just being an inspiration to me in so many ways. And I know to a lot of other devotees that you are just, yeah, a bright star in their life. So that's not supposed to go to your head. It's going to go to your heart. Put it in your heart.
Yeah, thank you so much to you and to all the devotees present here, the devotees in the Sangha, and all the people that, yeah, I've crossed in my path and will be crossing that. Again, I'm blessed to be of service to all of you, and the opportunity to bless you gives further meaning to my existence. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to be of service somehow.
Thank you so much. And just to let everybody know that next week, Indra will be doing an interview, and then we're going to be taking a break from the interviews for a couple of months. But we'll pick them up again in the summertime. And thank you so much for all the devotees who got on today. It's wonderful to have some beautiful smiling faces up there. Jai, Hare Krishna.
Gaur Hari Bol.